In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani, Seth Payne here. 713-572-4610, 572-4610. If you'd like to be a part of the show, good morning. Appreciate you joining us. A lot of funny comments coming through on the texts and YouTube, Seth. The cynicism alive and well on this show in regards to...
Directed towards whom?
Well... all of us, really. We're all taking a little bit. But Jeremy Pena, I love it. From the 832. Y'all think Jeremy Pena's now known glass ribs will help us in contract negotiations?
No, it won't. And honestly, obviously joking, but it won't, just because it's not a soft tissue injury where a guy's just continually either hurting his Achilles or getting sprained ankles, or, you know, Carlos Correa for a long time, it was his back when he was a younger player.
Yeah,
that was what people would be more concerned about, is, man, he seems to have these back issues. He figured that out. Yeah, the broken ribs are just something that happens when a baseball hits you sometimes.
I had two words for the person to text that in. I said, no. The reason being, Scott Boras.
Yeah. We saw Carlos Correa who had also had his rib issue, and that wasn't by a baseball. That was by allegedly a massage therapist's hands. He had his share of injury issues, including the one that kept him from signing his first two contracts that he had in free agency, because he had this mysterious lower leg issue, and he still got paid.
Rob Torres on YouTube says, just waiting to hear the news that Pena's in the hospital with a chest tube. I said, come on, man. Killing me. Chest tube. He's always worst case scenario, Rob.
There was. I mean, I was amazed that there were some people that were accusing others of overreacting after he got hit in the ribs, and there was no report of a break yet. There were people that were saying, oh, stop being so negative. Why are you expecting to have broken ribs? It's not negativity. It's using past results to inform what might happen in the future.
Yeah, well, and
it's not a guarantee of future results, but it'll tell you something.
The fact we have to do that with the Astros almost on a weekly basis is it's troubling to
me. Yeah, I need to read my SEC disclaimer that I use for financial products. Yeah, past performance does not indicate future results. No, it does. It does with the Astros, damn it.
Hey, talking about past performances, interesting segue. I feel like this has been more of a thing in hindsight. The offseason that C.J. Stroud had last year, you know, when he was traveling all over the world with Micah Parsons and sumo wrestling and doing podcasts, and just everywhere you looked, it seemed like, hey, C.J.'s doing something. Even here in town, what was he at the J.J. Watt Celebrity Softball Tournament with, that woman.
He was with the older lady there, James Harden's ex.
I can't remember.
I mean, she's 15 years younger than me, but older lady.
The picture that I saw of her last year at that time, significantly older than CJ for sure. Amber Rose, that's who it was. Yeah, just an innocent little carpool and a drop off at her place, I think, is what got people all up in arms. But no, so there was that, you know, and I feel like people mention this, and John McClain, who joins us on Area 45 every Wednesday, has mentioned this a number of times, and you see it, you know, written about and other areas from the national people, like, he's more focused this year. CJ's more focused this year than he was last year, as if he was not focused on coming off of a spectacular rookie season and trying to figure out how he can get even better, like as if that didn't happen. What did you think at the time? Be honest. What did you think at the time last year when you're watching all of that transpire with CJ during offseason?
Yeah, we've been 100% honest and transparent about that. I would say during the offseason last year, I'm trying not to be a grumpy old man that acts like these kids should never be doing anything except eating Wheaties and working out and all of that. It's a different era in which a lot of guys that are not doing anything extravagant necessarily in the offseason just... Everything that they do ends up on social media, so it gives the impression of guys that are just out living the jet set life and not caring. So I fought against it, but I never leaned too heavily into it during the season like it was an issue or anything. I fought against my own tendencies. Yeah. Like, I was cool with, okay, you're doing... I would prefer that, and CJ's learned this lesson. He cited Peyton Manning teaching him this lesson. I didn't like seeing Peyton Manning get into, like, if somebody asks you to power rank the best quarterbacks in the league, you just don't do it. Yeah. Like, that's the kind of stuff that ended up being a little bit, like, more extra drama that a quarterback doesn't need to be inviting either onto himself or onto a team. But it's not, in the grand scheme of things, a huge deal. The struggle with CJ last year more so was the classic thing that quarterbacks go through. especially when they don't have good offensive line or pass protection in front of them, where you got to adjust to the adjustments and what defenses are doing to stop your offense specifically. That was just something that sometimes there's no preparing for it until you actually see it in real time.
Yeah.
So I wasn't too worried about his offseason schedule last year.
I wasn't either. I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was very normal for a guy that literally made all of the rounds on Super Bowl Radio Row after the season that he had, and it bleeds into, you know, him doing things with another, you know, superstar in the league and kind of becoming like the face that he is now and is going to be at whatever level for the NFL as another young, budding, really good quarterback for the Houston Texans, mind you, this time. Think about that and then what he's doing this year. I thought this was kind of interesting. C.J. Stroud recently took a trip, and I think he took a number of teammates with him. I think I saw Tank Dell with him and maybe John Mechie.
Okay, there's two. You could talk about the Milan one first, and then the other one you're talking about was in Toronto.
They didn't go to the Milan one with him? That's what I was getting at.
That wasn't what was clear to me. I didn't know if it was just one happened after the other. After he was in Milan, there was he was in Toronto.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't go.
Xavier Hutchinson.
They didn't go, but the Milan one, the trip to Italy, I thought was kind of interesting. He went and toured the facilities of Inter Milan Soccer Club, and they did a sit-down interview with him and kind of got his impression of what he thought and, well, what he was doing there. Take a listen.
How have you liked it so far? What did you see, something that you liked in particular?
I like the trophies. The trophies are really cool, just all the history. And then the wall of, you know, the years of where it's back to the start now to where it is in the present, so... Just the history of everything and the trophies, all the wins you guys have had, it makes me, you know, want to win. And so, yeah, it's been cool.
So here's where my mind went with, you know, in hindsight, I feel like is where it happens most. Like people looking at like, CJ should have been more focused and, you know, not as much in the public eye last year, whereas he needs to be doing more of this. He needs to be seeking motivation and he needs to be looking at, ways to get better and learning his new offense under Nick Haley and things like that. But it was the first one where I was like, man, seeking motivation. I had a question for you. As a former player and now as a person that covers the Texans and follows the league, how have you seen like quarterbacks change or I guess evolve into like what motivates them in their search for that to improve from year to year?
I don't know. I don't know if anything's like as I don't think that anything's changed really. Like I don't like the really good quarterbacks are always the guys who are internally driven and, you know, most critical on themselves, just obsessed with it. And like I don't know if that's changed at all. I guess maybe the way that they're covered from social media and everything has changed, so you get more insight into their personal lives and their workouts and all of those other things. I mean, you got camera crews following them around in season for either Hard Knocks or the Netflix series and all of that. But at the end of the day, I like the things that drive really, really successful people the best. Like, has that really changed for anybody in terms of,
well,
like, no matter, like, from the 1950s until now, I think those guys are all generally wired pretty much the same way.
The reason why I ask is there's more money involved now. There's more opportunity for guys to afford themselves the ability to go seek out and do different things and learn different things. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. And maybe this was not at all like at the forefront of CJ's mind when he set out and, you know, did this trip. And maybe it's only something that he kind of stumbles upon is like, man, look at these trophies. What quarterback doesn't want to walk into their place of work and their stadium and their clubhouse locker room and see a trophy that they helped win, that, you know, they contributed to? And that's got to be some sort of like internal motivation that exists maybe more now than it did before for guys that didn't have like the opportunity to do it. because I feel like social media and media in general kind of drives a lot more of these things now than it did 15, 20, 30 years ago.
I like that. I'd be really skeptical that CJ specifically went on a trip to Italy just to be inspired by Inter Milano. The most likely explanation is he had some kind of a brand deal with him. So I guess that's probably,
there is an NFL relationship cooking there that he's very much a part of.
Yeah, they're doing some kind of a business related trip or whatever it might be. It's a really good point. I don't think most great quarterbacks always look to other great quarterbacks to look for inspiration, or you've got stories going back forever about, Joe Montana meeting with whomever and whatever. I think the opportunities and the things that they can do to improve are way different now than what they were in the past. You look at Jaden Daniels. Jaden Daniels and his use of that VR system, that virtual reality system, was probably the thing that transformed him into what he is. He started using that virtual reality system at LSU and continues to use, and it really, really works for him. Those options have been available for 10 or 15 years, but most of the previous versions were just crap. I think guys have, and then you look at Josh Allen. One of the things that changed Josh Allen and how he became a more accurate quarterback was just the computer analysis of his throwing motion and really fine tuning exactly where he's putting the weight on his feet. So back in the day, accuracy was almost considered an inborn trait. So there were a lot of quarterbacks that just figured, yep, they're either accurate or they're not. And I'm not going to tweak too much. I'm going to dance with the one who brung me, and the mechanics might not change all that much. Now they look at them more like pitchers, to where they can so much fine tune and refine things that the guys who really care about it, like Brady, his entire career kept working with the pitching coach, who I'm blanking on his name. I think that part's changed. I think Brady kind of set the bar for, all right, this is how much you actually can improve a lot of the physical traits that a lot of other people thought were innate and just unteachable. That you see a lot more of that with younger quarterbacks.
No, I think it's a good point, and it's a little bit closer to where I was going in my mind, is the example that you gave with Tom Brady and kind of the cross sport, training in, how is this guy, this pitching coach, how he approaches his athletes and teaches them, what can he do with me? How can he apply some things to me and my skill sets in a different sport that are going to, kind of take me next level? I think that's interesting. Where I was going with it is, from an exterior, motivational kind of a standpoint, CJ seems like a guy that is very curious about a lot of things. You go to a training camp practice with him, and he's got a regimen where, he's doing non-football activities to kind of warm up and, get loose. So he's swinging, acting like he's swinging a golf club, or doing, some very basketball movements, lateral movements, quick stuff, just something to kind of get ready for that day, right? Well, you could do those things from a mental standpoint, and there have been countless stories before where, baseball players want to go see how soccer players train and how they can maybe apply certain ideas or skill sets or practices to their craft.
Yeah, yeah. And your original question was, what are the motivations? I don't know if the motivations have changed. I think the actual tools that they have at their disposal.
The things that motivate.
But I guess if your original question is are they more motivated by money than they used to be, or the, there's more money to be motivated by, but in any industry or any field, really, the things that actually drive you tend to be more above and beyond just money, in that sport. There's a certain obsession with it that those guys would be, that they have the financial ability to do more, and they've got more tools at their disposal now than previous guys might have been. You can easily justify, if I spend $1 million a year on performance enhancement, and it's just 2% of your salary, there's a lot more you can do. And
it's a no-brainer, too.
If he did want to fly to Inter Milano just to talk to their coach or the players or something for inspiration, that's 100% more available to guys now than it used to be.
So you mentioned the trip to Toronto where Tank Dell, Xavier Hutchinson, Jaden Higgins, John Mechie, Jalen Knoll, Jared Wayne, like basically all the receivers were there. Where's Nico? They all went, you know, to Toronto together. This is something that is very common for quarterbacks to kind of do with their receivers. I feel like CJ did this maybe last off season, or it had to be last off season, right? Didn't he do some kind of a camp in California or something with his guys?
They were out at I think they were at Cal, right? They were at Cal or UCLA. They were just working out at UCLA.
Yeah, yeah. Those kind of a team building, you know, moments that you can have like before training camp starts. I love that. And my mind went like John Mechie in particular, well, Xavier Hutchinson too, from a receiver standpoint, those guys are entering into what I would call like their most pivotal training camp in their professional career. This is huge for them because of two other guys that are on the trip with them in Jalen Knoll and Jaden Higgins. they need production behind Nico Collins and Christian Kirk, which I feel like a lot of people, for some reason, are afraid to kind of hang their hat on. Like, Christian Kirk's been a very good receiver, but this is a huge training camp for Mechie and Hutchinson. Anything that they can get to be a step ahead or get ready before camp would be huge for them.
Yeah, no, and for Jaden Higgins and Jalen Knoll especially, I was curious about that. Okay, how much time is CJ going to have with those guys beforehand? It's hard to form that relationship just with training camp reps, and CJ didn't have that time versus OTAs and minicamp until the end there to really do a whole lot with these guys, as much as he probably would have wanted. So the fun part of this is that CJ got, I think he, in a lot of ways, got more of an education in his second season than he did in his first season. The difficulty level got ratcheted up so much that the kind of tips that CJ can dole out to a Jaden Higgins and Jalen Knoll this year is that much better than it was last year. And I would include in that the time that CJ spent with Stephon Diggs, I think, was probably really valuable. Everything that CJ could have learned from Stephon Diggs with what Diggs was focusing on this time of year when they were thrown together, what things to look for and all of that. That's where I think CJ's true value, if you go back to Tom Brady, Tom Brady's value in a lot of ways was he was a really good wide receivers coach. Like, he just had those guys so dialed in to how to respond to different coverages, to how to respond to different looks, that you can have that almost ESP level connection with them.
Yeah.
That's where I think CJ is going to be a much better wide receivers coach this year than he would have been this time.
It's funny you say that, because I was thinking of Nico Collins, like, tongue in cheek, asking like, hey, where's Nico on this, you know, Toronto trip? You know, if these guys are spending time together and, you know, just trying to do as much as they possibly can, and, you know, learning a new offense this offseason under Nick Haley, he should probably be there. And I thought, you know, Texans All Access interview that Nico did earlier this offseason with him was kind of interesting, because he was talking about like, hey, yeah, you know, now I'm kind of like the old guy in there now with Knoll and Higgins coming in. You know, Tank Dell obviously still a little younger than he is, but he also has Christian Kirk, you know, as a veteran that, you know, has probably some tricks of the trade, ins and outs. But Nico learned from Andre Johnson. Nico's tried to emulate, who is it, Julio Jones, that they always comp him to, or he talks about being an inspiration to him coming up. I thought like, hey, you know what, Nico's going to help in that regard too in camp with these guys when they're around each other more often.
Yeah, I'm not stressed out about him not being at the private workout.
No, I'm not either. I was thinking like that would be a great opportunity too, though.
No, the cool thing about the way the draft played out is that you're kind of set up with a mentor and a mentee with both the wide receiver, the rookie wide receivers. You got Nico Collins, a big body dude who runs routes like a smaller guy.
Yeah,
that's what Jaden Higgins aspires to be. And then with Jalen Knoll, you've got Christian Kirk in front of him, where the playing slot receiver, it's a lot like playing quarterback. You got to get really, really good at understanding coverages and getting your pre-snap keys and all of those things.
Yeah,
so to have Christian Kirk in front of Jalen Knoll, that smooths that transition out a lot. And that part, I don't know, you know, that's something that a lot of coaches or GMs strive for. It's not the specific reason you would draft a guy on draft day, but it worked out pretty well. Like, I kind of like with the Rockets, where you look at, oh wow, they signed Clint Capela and it it makes a whole lot of sense just in terms of, okay, now you've got some redundancy there at backup center.
Yeah.
Capella's not a young guy anymore.
Affordable depth.
Capella and Steven Adams being the pretty much the same age was the shock to me. That's the one that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me in my brain. But I think the tutelage factor can be huge. You just don't. I don't want to put it on Nico Collins that like he's responsible for Jaden Higgins' development.
No, not that at all. I was just saying that he feels like he can do that. That's almost like a job of his. You know, now at his stage of a Texans career.
Hey, by the way, this is where you got to be. You got to, when it comes to things like soccer and basketball, uh-huh, I always defer to Sean Pendergast's intelligence on these things. So when I was looking at the show prep and I saw it written Inter Milano, I was like, oh, I always thought it was Inter Milan, but I'm going to say Inter Milano, like it's a cookie or something.
So, I thought of Milano's.
You got to be extra careful with the typos on those things. Because yeah. I just said Inter Milano like three times earlier this segment. I'm like, no, wait, it's definitely Inter Milan.
Yeah. Pendergast would have corrected you on that
No. But he also would have written it in the show prep wrong. usually that's because he's drinking when he does the show prep.
He's Seth Payne. I'm Sean Bajani. In for said Sean Pendergast. Damian Pierce was a guest on Texans All Access last night with Mark Vandermeer and John Harris. A lot of good stuff from Damian. There always is. I love listening to this guy talk. He's so fun. Always dropping the knowledge. One of maybe the most transparent Texans that I can remember them having in any year. Lucky to have Damian Pierce, who's entering his fourth year. And just like I'd mentioned, Seth, along with John Metchie and Xavier Hutchinson, Damian Pierce, in my opinion, is one of those guys that's going into a pivotal training camp for himself, along with Darian Gumbawale. They asked him last night how he's taken to the new offense under Nick Caley.
It just comes down to how Coach Caley has organized and taught the playbook. You know, it's one thing to have a lot of plays and, you know, have a lot of players at your disposal. Oh, we got this for that situation. But if everybody don't understand it and it don't click and stick, it's kind of hard to go out there on game day and be completely confident in what you're doing. So Coach Caley has done a great job of, you know, micromanaging the playbook these last 3 weeks, you know, with phase one, phase two, phase three. You know, he's just been introducing bit by bit. And we just been understanding the whole picture as offense just that way. And you can tell him, man, he brings the juice every day. He's enthusiastic about what he does. He believes in what he does. And that's what we're buying into. That's what we're doing right now. This is what OTAs is for. Like, we're buying in right now. We're trusting what he got on the paper. And everybody seemed comfortable to me. That's one thing I can definitely tell you from last year coming this year. Everybody seems comfortable. Everybody seems confident in what they're doing. And, man, we got some good things brewing up.
Well, that's good news to hear from Damian.
Yeah, well, and you're expecting to hear positive stuff. I think the theme that I keep getting from either Nick Caley in his interviews or guys talking about Nick Caley is how dialed in he is on the fundamentals and on just the technique side of things. And when it comes to engineering a run game, for instance, when you've got an offensive coordinator who's got a passing background, that can be great in a lot of regards, but sometimes those guys aren't as fully educated about everything in the game, including like the run game became almost an afterthought for a decade or so in the NFL until all of a sudden last year teams are realizing, wow, defenses have also turned into being awful against the run. Let's run the ball. So that part of it, like the trend and the pendulum swinging back towards, whether you're the Eagles or the Ravens, running the football has its merits and it makes everything else better. But with Slowik, I never really got the sense that he was a technique guy. I felt like he was more of a scheme guy. With Caley, the fact that he's coached tight end as a position coach means that he's been heavily involved in both run blocking and pass protection and all those other things, but also the technique side of things. One of the things, and forget Caley's, you know, time in New England. I'm not making a direct, bring this from New England. Just Bill Belichick as a coach in general, the thing that always impressed me the most about watching clips of him in practice was how he could get down in the dirt and coach specific techniques to players.
That
a lot of times, as much as they laud the offense or the defense of those Patriots teams for the X's and O's, it really was at the ground level being better at coaching technique in a lot of ways. And that was something that was just drastically off last year with the offensive line. You could look, if you're a good high school coach, you could have watched the Texans offensive line last year and questioned, like, why? this is how coaches operate. They're like, I don't know if I would have done it that way. Then maybe there's something I'm missing. So if you're a high school coach that was watching the offensive line and thinking like, maybe there's something I'm missing, I just don't, that doesn't seem like proper tech. No, you're 100% right. That was not proper technique. It was just bad.
Yeah, yeah.
There was just bad fundamental football at tight end, at wide receiver, and a lot of that all flows back up to the offensive coordinator.
I can co-sign that, even just as a former middle school offensive line coach. It was just, you look at some of that stuff last year, and it's like, there's no way it's supposed to happen that way. Like, well, these guys' keys least, are all wrong.
You can't always, this is what's so frustrating when I always fact check myself with offensive linemen when I want to criticize the offensive line. Yeah. And it's always hard because the offensive linemen tend to be annoyingly pretty bright guys. And usually what I'll say something like, okay, so this is Kenyon Green's fault, right? 100%. And they're always like, well, it could have actually been one of seven things.
yes.
But I got tired of sending it so I would send it to those guys, you know, like Wade Smith, Drew Hodgson, former Texans player. I'll send stuff to Owen Daniels sometimes when it involves a tight end.
Yeah.
And I've never had so many times this last year of them saying like, I got to tell you, I'm not sure what's going on here. I'm not going to blame Kenyon Green, but I also know that of these three guys here, at least two of them are doing the wrong thing.
There was that one time earlier in the season with the Texans last year. It was one of Laramie Tunsil's really, really bad games. Okay. And I mean, really, really bad games. Like one where he had like four, maybe false start penalties within it and maybe a holding. There was a sequence where I think it was three straight plays, Seth, he just reminded me of it. It was a Laramie Tunsil, false start. And then it was whoever was playing left guard at the time. I don't know if it was Kenyon at that stage or not, but he had like a crick or something in his neck and he kind of moved a funky way and that elicited a flag for a false start. And then the next one was Juice Scruggs, who kind of yanked his head up a little too quick and that was a false start. And you just mentioned like, well, it could be this thing or that thing. It was literally that way with the Texans. Like you had to Zapruder that at some points last season to figure out like, well, why is it this bad? Why are these guys moving all over the place? They were all just about as panicky and anxious looking as as anything.
It was worse than that though, Sean. Because it was the Vikings game. They were in field goal range there at the Minnesota 25.
Probably that.
It was third and four. It was the Tunsil false start, then the Juice Scruggs false start, then the Laramie Tunsil false start.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd gone from being in field goal range at third and four.
That's right.
To finally third and 19. And that was an incomplete pass to Nico Collins. Wouldn't have mattered if it was complete because Laramie Tunsil had been flagged for illegal formation. Penalty was declined and the Texans
ended up. Do you have this sequence like in Bolden, like on your computer somewhere, like where you can reference it? Like you're way too familiar with this.
It's bookmarked. Yeah. Because I came up too many times. I referenced it enough times that I wanted to be sure about it. It was four straight. It was four straight pre-snap penalties.
Oh, Lord.
It was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable. That was the most infuriating game ever.
Oh, my goodness. Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. With getting back to Damian Pierce and something that you'd said, with what maybe we think we know or can devolve from Nick Caley and, you know, where he's come from, the systems that he's learned under the McVay tree and so on and so forth, like the signing of Nick Chubb. Texans utilizing running backs more as pass catchers out of the backfield, maybe something to anticipate this year. They asked Damian Pierce last night on Texans All Access about his ability and comfortability to be used that way.
Me, I've always just been a football player. That's the first thing everybody learned playing football, playing catch. That's how everybody got introduced to playing football. And one thing about me, the way I approach catching the ball is kind of fun. You know, every ball is not going to be the best ball. Like, I remember growing up, well, we used to play a lot of games involving football, but one of them used to be like, we used to call it like, it's kind of like the same theme as like the ground is lava. So if the ball touched the ground,
right.
You out. So the objective of us was like to throw you the craziest ball. Like, it was no good balls in that drill. So like, we'll be in the square, throw it low, throw it high, like just try to make you do these crazy catches. And like, that's like, we used to bet on that. Like, we'll probably put a dollar in, and you know what I'm saying? Or we'll put the, what they call it, the Fruit by the Foot. So I remember we had Fruit by the Foot, Slim Jim, and a ring pop in one time. So just
Andy up with the ring pop.
Yeah, man, you already know. So just catching the football, you know, I take a lot of pride. Like you said, it's a thing that comes natural to me. You know, I don't feel out of place not catching the football. And me personally, I like being in open space. I like me one-on-one.
The thing that I always get nervous about with Damian Pierce and Nick Caserio, you know, we disagree on this. We had a disagreement about this. I don't like the last couple years version of a slender, sleeker Damian Pierce. Just and Nick said, hey, he's as strong as he's ever been in the weight room. You know, he actually gained muscle, lost body fat. There's no replacement for heft sometimes. And I'll go back to Jerome Bettis. I don't know if Jerome Bettis would have been a better running back if he were 20 pounds lighter. Because Bettis was a lot like, his running style was a little bit like Damian Pierce in that he wasn't necessarily bulldozing people, he just broke tackles. Like, there were other running backs that I didn't want to, I would be more fearful of him lowering his shoulder into me, but Bettis was a guy that you would think you had lined up for a perfect form tackle, and then you just bounce off of him.
Yeah,
because he was such a large human.
Well, that's what made him is his size.
I don't need to hear about Damian Pierce and his pass catching ability. I want to see back the Jerome Bettis version from his rookie year, where maybe he was a little bit more rotund, but he broke tackles because that's his superpower.
Well,
and they've got you drafted a guy in Woody Marks to be your receiving threat. I need Damian Pierce to be a guy that can go in there, and if let's say one of the two guys ahead of him on the depth chart right now end up being injured, or both of them are injured at some point, that he can go in and just bulldoze yardage for you.
I totally get that, but help me understand this, because I'm always on the other side of the fence when people say, well, you know, look, the Texans have, you know, the guy, whether it be a Joe Mixon or a Nick Chubb, they've got those guys that can, you know, catch passes out of the backfield and stuff like that, and be the versatile, you know, the power backs as well, and break tackles. Why can't Damian Pierce be both? Like, in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't want to have, like, predictable personnel on a football field. Like, and I feel like that's a place that we've gone to before, you know, from a Texans point of view, even in the Slowick system, that you know what they're going to do based off of, like, who's out there.
So what's your question? Like, what?
Well, you're saying, like, Damian Pierce, like, you don't need him to be a pass catcher.
You can use him as a receiver. I just don't think that that's what he needs to hang his hat on. Like, yes, by all means, anybody on the field at any given moment needs to become a receiver, potentially. I just, like, the thing that made Damian Pierce special in his rookie year had really nothing to do with the stuff in space or being semblance of a scat back or anything. Like, he's fighting to make the team. So he needs to be viable as a wide receiver.
There you go.
I think that sometimes trying to cram a guy into a prototype of a player that he just most definitively is not, it does more harm to that player and the team itself.
Yeah.
So
I
see. No, by all means, yes, use him as a receiver when there's opportunities there. It's just that's not his calling card, and it likely never will be.
Yeah, I see. All right, we're on the same page then. We're on the same page. One more from Damian Pierce. Speaking of, like, being in space, why has he been such a good kick return guy for the Texans? The space has something to do with it.
It really not so much adapting, because I was a great returner like my whole life. It got to a point in high school where, like, they'll onside kick it rather than kick it to me. Right. So my coach was like, bro, you know, don't even worry about it. They're going to do all this. We just going to keep y'all. So, you know, kick return is just, like, me and Coach Frank like to call it a longer run play.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Like, it got to the point where Coach Frank, you know, we was thinking about this, adding this in the scheme, adding a little fold here. And then one day he was just like, man, you know what, DP, I'm just going to tell you which two guys we double team and we're going to go from there. Like, he has that trust in me. And I have that confidence in him to put me in the right position as well. So, you know, being with Coach Frank and, like you said, over the years, just gaining that trust and building that relationship and seeing it, you know, manifest on the field has been great.
Seth, I would say this. Talking about, like, the pivotal camp that this is for Damian Pierce, does it not benefit him greatly, the fact that he has been a return guy and a really damn good one for the Texans, in the situation that he's going in the running back room with Dari and Woody Marks and Chubb and Mixon?
It helps a lot. It's one more thing, especially when it comes down to final cuts and you start looking at, all right, just exactly which guys do we really like having on special teams. I think it gets a little murkier now because for one, you've got Braxton Berrios on the team, and he's going to get a lot of, if he makes the squad. I mean, there's going to be battles on special teams. That might end up being one of the weird decisions you're making between, okay, are we going to keep Braxton Berrios or keep Damian Pierce because of the potential return ability? But at the same time, you know, Jalen Knoll can be a returner. How much do you want to use him early in his career? How much do you trust him? I like having Damian back there. There's going to be more returns this year because of the rule change. The touchback now is at the 35. So last year, where a lot of teams were just flat out saying this new kickoff format, no, we're just going to boot it into the end zone and that'll be that.
Yeah.
This year, there's probably going to be a lot more returns.
So
that it becomes that much more of a factor in the decision making.
Need to see more Damian Pierce in those explosive runs, man. What do you have? One of 100 yards, 99 yards last year, I think, for the Texans. That's fun. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Coming up next, we'll get back to some Rockets. Inside some numbers, how much better are the Rockets going to really be off the ball with Kevin Durant? That's next.